No, I don't want the fame and glory. I just want to be a light.
Good day, people. This is Miss CC, the Real Infopreneur, and you are listening to Miss CC, the Real Infopreneur. Okay, so today my guest is Dr. Marcia Tate Arunga. Now, I don't know if you all have ever heard of her, but she actually is an educator, cultural custodian, and entrepreneur who has also taken part in the Black Panther Party. So I want to invite her here today. Welcome, Dr. Arunga.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to be with you, Cece.
Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you again for coming to talk with us today. So in the midst of all these things going on in our communities, with our Black lives not mattering so much to where we're still being killed, I wanted to talk with you about your involvement in the Black Panther Party, the chapter in Seattle. Can you talk to us about that?
Oh, I would love to. What an honor it was to be involved. I should clarify a few things. My time in the Black Panther Party was kind of the second wave. It came after the gun-toting days of protection in the community. A lot of our original Black Panthers were incarcerated as a result. Yeah. And Elmer Dixon himself, in fact, served about 2 years for trumped up non-reasonable charges, but he did serve his time. When he came out in 1976, that's when we met. He was trying to revitalize the Black Panther Party and to also preserve the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party. And so he started something called the Sidney Miller Free Medical Clinic. It was located in the Seattle central area. It was named after one of the fallen Black Panthers who was very committed to the health of Black people in the community. I got to work with a fabulous leader called Carolyn Downs. Carolyn Downs was involved in the sickle cell anemia testing at the time. My job was to go around with her to early childhood programs where we could identify children who needed to be tested. At that time in the 70s, there were no tests that were given for sickle cell anemia. So we had no knowledge as to whether a child was born with the trait or with anemia. So the Black Panther Party was one of the organizations that really brought awareness about sickle cell anemia to the country and made it an urgent matter. One of the other projects that I worked on was the Children's Free Breakfast Program, and it was essential that children be fed breakfast before they went to school. This was during a time where the school system did not feed breakfast to children. As a matter of fact, that program, the advent of public schools feeding breakfast to children, was a result of the work of the Black Panther Party. And we used to basically raise money by shaking cans, selling newspapers, and then taking that money to buy groceries. Eventually, we built relationships with grocery stores and supermarkets where they would give us food, and we were able to prepare breakfast for the children. So we did that work, groceries, free groceries. These were things that were not even readily available to the public. It was the Black Panther Party who went and took groceries, foods that the grocery stores relinquished to them to make grocery bags for our elderly. A lot of people do not understand that that was the purpose of the Black Panther Party. It was a social service urgency. The fact that no one was taking care of our community, no one was protecting our community, our children were left fallow to be hungry as they went to school with very limited resources. And so to be involved with the Black Panther Party at that time was really more about service, and it's always been about service to the people. This is what all power to the people really mean. The protection of the Black Panther Party of their community, really what they were doing was exercising their First Amendment right and their ability to hold and to protect their community. So with all of that in place, it was just an honor and a privilege to serve in the Black Panther Party and to serve our people. And the reason why 20 years later, when I was watching the movie, The Black Panther, and that's how I connected back with Elmer Dixon, the founder of the Black Panther Party in Seattle. We went to a children's, a early childhood school. In Black History Month, and it was also when the Black Panther movie was coming out. And the children really asked him, they thought that we were people who were from Wakanda and, you know, turned into panthers. They had no idea about the history. And that is when I really saw it necessary that we see the history of the Black Panther Party that was really, truly, it really was Wakanda. It was it was Black people with who had the guts to get out and protect their community. And even though they were really gunned down by the police, the police were definitely on the offensive. There were people who were killed. Fred Hampton, I want to remember him, killed in his own bed.
That's his pregnant wife.
Indeed. Young teenagers killed. Bunchy Carter was one of the first people killed. He was 14 years old when he was gunned down. And so these were people who literally sacrificed their lives. And I believe they saw a day like this that we're living in now in 2020. And one of the responsibilities we have is to look back and see what were the roles of the protectors in our community. How do what is it we can learn from them, and what are some of the gems? So I just am really honored to have participated in that time and to have really given service. It caused me to, in my college days, to go back and study sociology because I wanted to understand society better, and I wanted to understand how we could be more enfranchised as Black people in the United States. These were all inspirations from my dealing with the Black Panther Party.
That is an amazing story. And we can talk about the Black Panther Party as you have in such a tremendous light, because as you said, some of the programs that have been installed into the community came directly from the Black Panther Party. But if some would listen to bad news or fake news or false news, they would think that the Black Panther Party was a gun-toting militant group that was out to kill white people. And that's not what it was about at all.
That was not what it was about, Cece. In fact, we had so many white supporters. There were actually white people who were part of the Black Panther Party. So there was always alliance and collaboration.
Right. So I totally want to make sure that people have the opportunity to look more into the Black Panther Party. That is a necessity, because you shouldn't just sit back and not be concerned with how news and information is given to you. You should always want to dig deeper. I mean, that's something that you learn in school. But, you know, sometimes we just get so used to social media and just grabbing whatever is given to us.
You're raising something very important about the demonization of Black people. I think that any time that we have really made an effort to come together, to protect each other, to start organizations that would help us traject well in the future, those programs, our leaders have always been sabotaged. So I think that's a lesson going into the future.
You're right. It is a lesson, because I'm sitting and I'm on social media all the time. But, you know, you have people saying, why don't we have this? Why don't we have that? Why don't we have this? But those are people that don't quite understand what has happened throughout history. We have had, but every time we do have, the saboteurs come in and kill off what it is that we have and what we're building. Therefore, we can never build generational wealth and generational legacies. And it causes us to further lose our identity, not just with our history, but who we are within our own communities and with each other.
Yes. And you're raising something about the omission of facts in our history as well, Because if we knew the correct information about the Black Panther Party, or if we knew the correct information about Black Wall Street of 1920, when we really did have a strong community and we were the largest millionaires per capita in the country. But these are informations that are buried and we don't get to know the genius or the majesty that our race has given to this country. And I think that that's done intentionally. It is up to us as Black people, especially educators, writers, to share information, because we don't expect the European American to necessarily tout our history. But it is very important that we know our history and that we're able to create new models. We use these people as models for our future. If I know that we can be a doctor because I see doctors in front of me, then it's nothing for me to be a doctor. Yeah. So these are the ways we have to take control of the future of our race.
Absolutely. And to hand it down to our children, that is the greatest wealth ever, for them to understand their rich history and that we have been the creator and the inventors. We are the first of civilization. It is important that they know that. But in school systems, they don't teach that. And I am a big supporter of homeschool. I love for children to be homeschooled. But for whatever reason, some parents are not able to. If they do send them out into the world, I think that it is important that they take the time on the weekends or in times off to re-educate their children, because that's what it is. They have to be re-educated into what it is that they should be knowing about themselves, because they don't have that, they won't have the tools to move forward through this society. And it shows like what we're going through today. I have an example. You know, yesterday I was looking out my window and I saw some young kids driving down the road, and they were driving kind of crazy. And I can see this because I live way up. And they were hanging out the car, loud music. Now, I'm in St. Louis. This is not okay. I'm in St. Louis City, hanging out the car, you know, enjoying themselves. I get it. But not in the seatbelt, shirt off, loud music, all kind of attention drawn to them, you know, because they were just having a good time. But as parents, we have to educate our children. What is it that you need to be doing to survive? It doesn't mean you run and hide. It doesn't mean that you don't get to be you, but it means that you want to come home at night.
Oh, okay? Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It means that you want to come home at night. We have to teach them that, you know.
And it also means that we have to create a world in which they can live freely.
Absolutely. So we
don't have to happen in our lifetime, but I think we have to push for that.
Yeah, so we don't have to be concerned.
The beauty of young people hanging out of a car and having a good time, is that illegal? Yeah. But for us, we have learned, and I think some of that is a lot of restriction. Sometimes it's restriction that is not due to our young people. They should also have some chance to be free.
They should, and I definitely agree with that. And there's no but there. I definitely agree with that, and it saddens me that I, as a mother, as a grandmother, have to have that sort of, you know, trepidation, you know, like, oh my goodness, they shouldn't be doing that. I'm scared for them. I want to run down, you know. And I had the conversation with my sister, and she understood, and she was like, oh my goodness, just yesterday, I was at the store and this young guy's car alarm went off and he couldn't turn it off. So he was just going to keep driving down the street with it on. But she said, I ran over to him and I helped him disconnect that thing because I didn't want him to draw attention to himself. So we were kindred in that situation. It was like she wanted to make sure that he wasn't drawing attention to himself, you know, so she helped him disable that car alarm. And I was like, I get it. I understand.
Oh, that's how we have to help each other.
Yes, that's beautiful.
Thank you for that story.
So in these times, you know, we have to be able to teach our children even outside of whatever the school is teaching them. So you wrote a book called The Stolen Ones and How They Were Missed. I want to definitely get into that because we could stay here all night, I'm telling you.
That goes back to the whole idea of omitting facts.
Yes.
Because, yes. First of all, there's some imagery about Africa in this country. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter whether you're black or white. You turn mm-hmm. on the TV at night. You mm-hmm. see those starving black children with the flies all over their face.
And the big bellies.
The big bellies. And yeah. they look so, you know, desperate. And we're supposed to give our money, you know, to pay for that. And right. But it also creates an image of Africa that is not an accurate image.
Yes.
Of course, there is poverty in Africa. Mm-hmm. But there is more than poverty. There is also wealth mm-hmm. in Africa. There's also
prosperity.
Yes. yes. And there uh-huh. is lushness and beauty. Mm-hmm. There are minerals. There are diamonds. 75% of the world's resources are in Africa. So right. why would we only want to paint one small image that's a very negative and desperate image when we are talking about the richest continent in the entire world, yes. In terms of raw materials and natural resources.
Absolutely.
The other thing, the reason I wrote this book had to do also with the many stories as a child growing up. Even as a Black Panther, people say, I'm Black, I'm not African. Have you ever heard that?
Oh, we say we're a whole bunch of different stuff. I mean,
yes. You know, I lived in Kenya for 11 years. All of my uh-huh. children were born in Kenya, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
And when we moved back to the United States in Seattle, mm-hmm. My children went to school and they had strong African accents. And they would come home and they would ask me questions about, what is an African booty scratcher?
Oh.
Now, I learned that those were the names that people, African Americans were calling my African American children. Because they had accents and they had been to Africa, there was a perception that they were different and uh-huh. that they were not
less than
uh-huh. and that there was a hostile relationship. Mm-hmm. I began to explore the hostile relationship that we had mm-hmm. With each other. Mm-hmm. And so I started taking people back to Africa where mm-hmm. I had lived, which was Kenya, mm-hmm. East Africa.
Yeah. Yes.
And I decided to take women back first mm-hmm. because women, African-American women are actually the culture bearers. Mm-hmm. As mothers, we pass mm-hmm. the culture to the next generation. Even mm-hmm. the discussion we were having earlier, Cece, about some of the information our children don't know is because yes. it has not been passed from the last generation.
Yep.
So this cultural transmission is critical.
Mm-hmm.
So when I took the women to Africa on our mm-hmm. first visit, we sat in the backyard of our hostess. And mm-hmm. This particular hostess lived in the city, Nairobi, mm-hmm. hustle mm-hmm. bustle. She lived in a beautiful home that her and her husband had built.
Wow.
It had about 10 bedrooms. There was Ooh. A room for all of us to sleep in.
What?
I was with seven women. We all had a bed.
You guys weren't in a hut?
No, we were not. We were in a beautiful home. I wish I could show you the picture now. And so
no, that's what they think though. They think it's a hut. Like you got to be in a hut when you go to
everyone America. Believes that we're talking about people who don't wear clothes, who uh-huh. have no education, who don't understand what it is to live a good quality modern life.
Right.
So this particular hostess invited other women leaders around okay. the country to come and greet us.
Wow.
And one of them was an elder. She came from a place called Taita Hills. And Taita Hills is just close to the Indian Ocean. So
okay.
her history, she had a deep history, which was mm-hmm. an oral history. And mm-hmm. we sat talking in the backyard. And mm-hmm. she asked us after some conversation, you know, my friend had a photo album. So mm-hmm. she was showing her, you know, this mm-hmm. is an African-American school. This mm-hmm. is an African-American church. Mm-hmm. This is an African-American club. Mm-hmm. And the elder said, oh, African-American. Well, mm-hmm. you keep calling yourselves African. Where from Africa do you come from? Well, mm-hmm. you know, we couldn't answer that question because
right.
as I began to share, mm-hmm. we didn't know quite where we had come from. We knew yeah. that there were people dragged all over Africa mm-hmm. to the coastlines
right.
to serve the purposes of the transatlantic slave trade. And when I explain that to her, she gets this epiphany. And she said, oh, you must be the stolen ones.
Oh. Now,
you know, I had just met this woman for the first time, so I had no idea what she was talking about. And we asked her what she was saying. And she began to explain. And it was through this explanation that I wrote this story, The Stolen Ones. And what I learned was that it was about the stolen ones, but even more so, we knew we were stolen. We knew that it wasn't an organized operation of selling bodies to the United States or to other European countries. It wasn't that organized. In fact, the trinkets that they were selling were not even as valuable as the gold and the other kinds of precious stones that are in Africa.
Right.
What we didn't know, other than being stolen, was that we were missed. That we had been missed by the people who we had gone missing from. So, as we were told the story, I embellished the story and created it in a children's book because I knew that I wanted the children to first read this story and to understand their own heritage. That when they start to think about who they were, that they would know that not only were they stolen, but they were missed by their people. So I created a story with, I'm just going to share some images with you. Like
now,
this image.
Tell us who your illustrator is again. Who's your illustrator?
Yes, the illustrator is Isaiah Townsend.
Okay.
At the time of writing this book and him doing the illustrations, he was 18 years old.
Oh, wow.
And he was a senior in high school.
Okay.
And he did these illustrations. He actually was going to be failed from his high school because his white teacher was not happy with him drawing only black and brown faces. And he told the child, you know, you must learn to stretch. Don't just draw black and brown faces. Learn to draw other faces. And when I heard that story, I said, find that young man and bring him to me. I want him to draw those faces for me. Because how often do teachers tell white children that they need to stretch and begin to draw black and brown faces? It doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen.
It was a beautiful story, and he indeed turned out to be just the artist that I was looking for.
Wow.
And so we created this young girl called Nia. And if you know in Swahili, from Kwanzaa, we have a day called Nia. Nia actually means purpose. In Kiswahili. Okay. So this book is an allegory because I want us to think about what would happen if we have no purpose in our village. What happens to a village when there's no purpose and you're basically living like flotsam and jetsam from day to day, not understanding your purpose in life? And I think that her purpose was very clear. She was a very talented gardener. And the reason why that was important was because we learned in my history after doing research, after telling the story, I learned later that when people went into Africa to search out the kinds of people they were taking, they were looking for particular skill sets. And in this particular area, they were looking for agriculturalists.
Okay.
So it was no mystery that they would want to take a girl like Nia, who was a farmer and knew how to grow food and vegetables and fruit. Those were the seeds that many Africans brought to America to grow here, to build the agricultural society that is now known as America, because everything was used for an agricultural base. They also went to Benin, places like Benin, where people could work with metals. They needed people who could work with metals so that they could bring them here to make the gates, the iron gates, farm implements like shovels, needed to be made with metals. So they were looking for people in Africa with particular skill sets that would be needed to grow a whole civilization, a whole country.
Right. And that's what we've done.
Yes, and that is what we came to do, and that is what we achieved. We built this country to be one of the greatest countries, economic countries in the world. And yet, have been totally disrespected for the service that we have given. And that's why I wrote this book. And I wrote the book for children, even though it's an allegory. It's a book that all ages should read and have in their library. But I wrote it for children because I knew that myself and for my own children as they were growing up, and when they hear those stories about slavery and they hear how we contributed nothing to civilization, or that, oh, get over it, your people sold you and you're in a better place. That actually, no, we had a home where we were living in peace and harmony, and that we were stolen from that home, and that people miss us. Even to this day, our ancestors are still in Africa wondering what happened to us. And I wanted to know that so that we could lose that kind of rub that we have between Africans and African Americans. It boils down to this question. Two brothers who might have been living, loving, having wonderful lives in Africa, all of a sudden one goes missing. Just disappears. No one knows what happened to him. And he ends up in America. He has family. He gives birth. Now, many generations later, here we are meeting each other, a continental African who may even be a cousin to an African American. And yet we don't even recognize our common genealogy.
Right.
And I want to show you the front of the book. Do you see all the children? These are all children. We must know in my research that 62% of the people who were taken from Africa were actually between the ages of 9 and 25. They were not old people. They were very young. And the reason they took young people, which, you know, we can kind of figure the logic of that.
Right, yes.
They would have a longer life to give servitude. They were less likely to resist, to fight back. And so for those reasons, so many of these young people, these would be the doctors, the lawyers, the planters, the nurturers, the healers, all of the people who made Africa work were taken away, left with the very old and the very young to fend for themselves. And so when I think of underdevelopment that occurred in the African continent, we also have to understand, like Walter Rodney, one of our great historians, he wrote a book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And it's so important that we think of, it wasn't just underdeveloped. We're not talking about Africa, oh, this underdeveloped place. No, it was underdeveloped out of robbery, out of theft, out of taking, not only taking the people, the most able-bodied people out of the continent, but it also following it by its resources, which I've already said is over 75% of the world's resources. Our very cell phone, all of the all of the electronics that we use, uses columbite, which can only come out of the Congo in Africa. This is a mineral that is found underground. This is how all technology operates.
And they still have children mining that.
Yes, people are, they have children mining it and not getting paid even a dollar a day. Yet, it's an industry that has made immense wealth for the West. So we also have to revalue raw materials in Africa and begin to understand, because those of us even who have African blood need to understand how wealthy Africa really is. If we don't know, then we won't understand the need to protect it. So right now, this idea of the poor child with the flies all over.
The ones that they're vaccinating.
Yes, and that they have to fix, you know, because Europe wants to fix everybody. All of that is to our detriment.
They want to kill everybody. That's what they want to do. They want to make it look like fixing, but they want to kill everybody, because that's what they're doing. They're killing off all of the resources that should be available to the people that live on the continent. They're destroying the people in the continent so that they can come and do what they always do, which is kill, steal, and destroy. That's what they're famous for, period.
And one of the sad things is that excavating all of those minerals and the gold and diamonds out of the earth, copper, aluminum, you name it, have actually tilted the earth because it no longer is balanced in the way that we understand the earth. So there are many things that are impacting our environment based on greed and of people. But, you know, I realize everyone has to take some blame, but I want to talk about people of African descent and our sense of agency, our need to understand what is in our power to be able to reel in our families, raise them in ways that they will be successful and productive for the world. What ways might we look to cooperating and collaborating with the African continent in business entrepreneurship so that we can now help to broker a just economic relationship? I think that those are things we have to think about. We are no longer the same people. We're not enslaved. We're free. Yeah. So we have to also think
not
about
by their constitution, though. Not by their constitution. Their constitution says something else. But, you know, we need to talk about the college. What is your involvement with the college? Please talk to me about that. And also the wonderful founder, Professor Mims, please. Yes. Because, I mean, there's so much to talk about, but I think you can do it.
I have to do it. I stand on the shoulders of Dr. Maxine Mims. She's the founder of Evergreen State College, the Tacoma campus, where I'm now the dean. And it is one of the most diverse colleges in the state of Washington. At one time, we actually called it the historically black college on the West Coast. But now it really is quite diverse. It continues to be diverse. And it also stands on a kind of black pedagogy, an African-centered idea of liberation, freedom, education. What ways does education free our minds? What ways can we make a strategy for liberation? These are the ways that we look at education at Evergreen State College Tacoma. And that's because we started it. It's our institution. It's it's a school where we've tried to eliminate a lot of the competition that you find in education. So, for example, we don't give grades. We actually give assessments and evaluations.
Okay.
Classwork, we have our students are generally 38 years old is the average age. And so we are working with adult students who have been out in society and they just realize, okay, I need to go back and get that degree that's commensurate with what I know, what my skill set is. And we give them an opportunity to really look at and lean into the area that they want to pursue by pursuing something a little bit more independent. So it's quite independently guided. Mm-hmm. And it's a BA completion program. So if you have started your BA, but you never finished it, Evergreen is the school for you. And I have been now the dean for 1 year. And I tell you, I am so honored to really uphold the principles and ideals that Dr. Mims espoused. Mm-hmm. After Dr. Mims left was another black woman called Dr. Joy Hardiman. So I'm just really blessed to represent that college. And I'm looking all the time for black students because one of the things they believed was that we need to always have the right configuration of diversity in a classroom in order for people to grow and really accelerate their growth with each other. And we're looking at what does society look like when we're in one space, looking with our cultures in front of us, you know, where our best thinking is and how to build trajectories of success. Mm-hmm, I'm just really excited about my new role at Evergreen.
Well, let me ask you this. So with the changing times, of course, we're dealing with the COVID, which I didn't want to talk about, but we're dealing with the changing times and loss of jobs and people are in certain situations. I'm not sure if there's an influx of people wanting to go back to school, because I think that people are looking and saying, in a broad sense, what is it that I should be doing right now? Is school going to be helpful to me? I still have financial aid payments from whenever. Like, now I don't even have a job. So I think they're probably all over the place. I mean, I personally know somebody that lives right there in Tacoma. She does have her degree. I don't know if she's thinking about going back to school, but I know she's not even using it. So I'm just wondering what is the thought right now concerning school? What are you
seeing? So first of all, I want to say this. You're always using your degree. Always using your degree.
That's good.
Okay. The other thing I'll say is you are right. Everybody, college is not necessarily for everyone. I this is the big argument between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, who thought, we need to know how to work with our hands. And W.E.B. Du Bois said, no, we need to be scholars and the talented 10th. And actually, both were right. When I look at people like Dr. Mims and Dr. Hardiman, who precede me, the reason I pursued my PhD was because I didn't want that tradition to die out. I thought that they really paved a way for people to get their degrees. And
that's what they actually, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And with the genius that we, that is Black people, we actually should just have our degrees. Like, it's not even that big of a deal. Just have your degree. Especially a BA degree. Like, we should just all have it, right? It's not something that, we should be struggling for. And I say that, Cece, knowing that we do struggle because of the way the system is set up. But in a just world, it recognizes that we actually have genius and we bring a lot to the classroom. I can verify that we bring a lot to the classroom.
I agree. We definitely bring a lot to the classroom. But as times change, I would hope that the education system changes from pre-K all the way up to collegiate folks, that it changes because we historically have not been included and they are not teaching to how we learn. They are not teaching our history and our information, which again is important because how am I supposed to feel like I can thrive if you're not teaching me about me? You're just teaching me about you. You're teaching me how to deal with you and be a good lapdog. And that's not what it should be. It should be as a whole. I'm learning how to function in this society as well as love myself, you know?
Yes.
So, I mean, I definitely, you know, if people want to go to college, that's great. I think that they should definitely pursue it. So what I need to do right now is make sure that people know how to purchase your book, The Stolen Ones, How They Were Missed. How can they purchase this book?
Well, you can get the book through Amazon. At this time, that's the only place I think it's available, but it's readily available through Amazon.
Okay.
You only need to, you know, ask for The Stolen Ones and How They Were Missed. You could ask by my name. And so it'll be sent to you in that way. We were selling the book in Black, bookstore in the Seattle area, Life Enrichment Bookstore, which, is trying to actually reopen right now as we speak. So I hope that, soon we'll be selling our book in that store as well. But until then, you can get it through Amazon.
Okay. Well, I definitely appreciate your time with me today and with the rich history that you have brought to us. Hopefully those listening, those new to Black history and information, welcome. We want you to continue doing research. And if you want to reach out to Dr. Marsha in order to go to college, she's willing to help you do that. And if they want to reach you, how would they do that?
I think I will give my private email, which is Marsha. Arunga@gmail.com. If you contact me, I will make the necessary connections for you. We would love to have anyone who's ready and serious about building Black institutions and studying more about our history and also about our sense of Black economics. We have a lot to look at, Cece. There's so much to be studied in order for us to build the institutions that we need to build. And I believe that Evergreen is that kind of college. It's Black friendly, and we need to build that. So
Black friendly. That's what we like to hear. Wonderful. Well, we definitely want to invite you back. If you have some other things that you want to enlighten us on, we will happily have you here. Okay, Doctor?
What a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
You guys have been listening to Miss Cece, the Real Infopreneur. Join us again later. Thank you.